So we're going to be, they turned me up. There you go. We're going to be sharing our testimonies. And they said, you're going to start. So here we go. I was born in a great family. My parents loved me. I had no problems in my upbringing as far as, as middle class family. We had really didn't want for anything. And, that was all going really good. But my mom and dad, they fought a lot. They bickered and they didn't slap each other or hit each other. There was nothing physical, but there was a lot of contentious disagreement and physical distance, and it seemed like they were just always arguing. And to a young girl, I looked at that and I said, well, if that's what marriage is, I want nothing to do with it. And so, and I made that decision by the time I was about 7 or 8 years old watching this, so I was pretty young. But I watched it and I made this heart decision. If that's marriage, I want nothing to do it. I'm never going to get married. Another thing that did happen that I remember very clearly when I was about 4 years old, my dad, 4 or 5, but I think I was about 4. My dad was home on a Saturday morning. He was on his hands and knees. He had the newspaper spread out in front of him, and he was just on his hands and knees reading it, which is kind of what he did every now and then. And a 4-year-old girl that looked like a horse. So I got up on his back and I started, I grabbed the back of his, t-shirt, and I started playing, like giddy up and horse and having a great old time. And in my childlike exuberance, I grabbed him around the neck and swung underneath him and gave him a big old kiss on the lips. And when I did, he grabbed me and he pushed me down and he said, don't you ever do that again, right in my face. And when he did that, it was like an awakening moment. I had never had my love rejected by anybody as a 4-year-old. I live in a very loving family, really. And it was coming at the hands of my dad. And so it frightened me. I was actually frightened of my dad from that time on, until I was in my teens. But as a child, I was a little bit afraid of my dad. And I made another heart decision to just shut my heart down to him because I didn't want my love rejected again. And I didn't want to experience that kind of pain. And I was a little afraid of him. So by the time I was 7 or 8, I had made these two decisions. I'm never going to get married and I'm not going to open up my heart to my dad. And honestly, not opening up my heart to my dad ended up being not opening up my heart to men. And when he pulled me off his back after I kissed him, it put shame down into my soul because I took it in as it's not safe for me as a female to express physical affection to my dad, but a man, it went down both ways. So my life just kind of operated out of those two things for a while. I couldn't tell you, like I can tell you now, that those pieces were so important to my story, but those two pieces were huge. I was also molested by a female neighbor several times when I was young. And it was in the context of play, but it wasn't play. I now know it was molestation. So those three things really started playing on my confusion about who I was and how to show my affection as a female. So growing up, go through high school, when I was in my, I would say like late teens, 19, 20, 21, I started to develop same-sex attraction. And I didn't like it. I didn't like the feeling. I didn't like what I was experiencing and I didn't want anything to do with it, but I didn't know what to do with it. And so, after high school, my friends are going off to college, they're getting married, they're getting engaged, and I just thought, I don't want anything to do with that, but I don't like these feelings of attraction towards women, so I'm just gonna not date anybody, no men, no women. I got recruited into a college on a golf scholarship, and started playing golf, went on to play as a professional on the mini tour, the minor leagues of the LPGA tour. And from there just went off and worked in the industry. And I loved golf. It was wonderful. It was everything to me. I loved watching it. I loved playing it. I loved talking it. I got this job, and at the job, I was at a business meeting. This job was in golf. And when I walked into the meeting, I looked across the room, and there was a woman in the room, and our eyes met. And, you know, attraction comes through the eyes, really, doesn't it? I mean, it's how we look at somebody, that they kind of know what we're thinking. And I was immediately attracted to her, and I could see she was attracted to me. And in that moment, I heard the Lord say to me, "This is trouble." And I am now, I got saved when I was 33. I got saved kind of late. So he said, "This is trouble." And I said, "You're right. This is trouble. I agree, because I'm really attracted to her." And so I said, I won't be around her. I'll just be cordial. I won't get involved in her world. But I hit a point in that job where I was a little bit struggling with what was going on. I didn't know exactly how to handle it. I was about to quit. And I was at another meeting, and this girl came and sat next to me. And she said, "How are you doing?" And I just unloaded on her, because I just needed somebody to talk to about how I was kind of flailing around in this job. And she said, "Oh, don't worry. I can help you. I can help you get it all organized and straightened out." So I said, "Okay," you know, and at that point, I disobeyed God, really, because I started going to her office. We started doing things after hours as far as, talking and work and combining those things. And then it turned into a friendship, and then it turned into a dating thing, and then it turned into a romantic thing. And then I was really in trouble, because I had done just exactly what God told me not to do. And so at that point, I'm crying out to God. My stuffed down affection that I just contained all those years just was uncontainable at this point. It was like if you took a Coke bottle and shook it up and took the cap off, it just comes out everywhere. And that's how I was experiencing this relationship. So I was crying out to God, "I need your help. I just cannot resist this. There's a power that's beyond my ability." And by the way, I was a born-again Christian. I wasn't just a nominal Christian. I was baptized in the Spirit. I was on the mission field. I was all about Jesus. But we're body, soul, and spirit, and my spiritual man had been doing well for a long time, but my emotional man, my soul, was broken and struggling with things that I didn't realize were hidden down in there. So I'm crying out to God for help. And one night we're sitting in my car, me and the woman that I was madly in love with, and we're talking about something, and I mentioned something about scripture. She wasn't a believer, I was. And I mentioned something about Jesus, and she just turned to me and she said, "Shut up. I am so sick of hearing about scripture, about Jesus. I don't want anything to do with him. I don't want to be a Christian. And if you mention him again, I'm going to get up out of this car and you'll never see me again." And in that moment, like, my deception that I was under lifted. And I realized that I had to make a decision. So I started counting the costs. Do I want her, the thing that I want most on this earth, the thing that my emotions are invested in, or do I want the Lord and his love for eternity? And it was a really radical battle. I mean, it was like the forces of good and evil were in my car. It was like Star Wars. Everything was going crazy. But in the end, I decided to go with Jesus and not with her, which was the hardest decision I've ever made in my life, because she was everything I really wanted to be with. But I made that choice with my will, not my emotions. And to walk in obedience to the Lord sometimes is an act of the will more than your, my heart was with her, but the deeper part of who I am and what I knew about God was with him, and I belonged to him. I had the Spirit of God dwelling in me, and I was meant to reconnect with God and not with her. So I made that choice with my will, best choice I ever made. And there's a lot more to this story about my healing journey. I don't have time to tell you, but if you want to know more about that, my book's in the back, and you can get the rest of the testimony about what God did to actually change my attractions. So anyway, thank you.
Good morning. How are y'all doing? Thank you so much for being here. So my name is Kevin Witt, and the man that you see today is not the man that I've always been. I was born into a very dysfunctional family in the South. Actually, I was born in Arkansas, so it's the real South. My father was very verbally abusive, physically abusive, and spiritually abusive, and sexually abusive, unfortunately. And so whenever I was growing up, I was really a feminine kid. I was a really feminine boy, and my dad always wanted to have this Superman, macho man boy, and that wasn't what I was, you know? And he tried everything, taking me fishing and hunting and all that. I hated all that. I would rather be playing in makeup or something, you know, creating something beautiful. And so that is just, you know, my dad was, I saw him abusing my mom physically. You know, he tried to cut her throat at one time. She grabbed a blade and he sliced her hand open. He threw her out of a moving car. So my dad was, this is the kind of man he was. And whenever he started sexually abusing me, it was because in his mind, he was teaching me how to be a man. And men masturbated every day to remind them that they were a man. And he would teach me how to like spoon a woman. And all the things that you would do to a woman, my dad would do to me to teach me how to do it. And so, and I thought that that was pretty normal, actually. And then, but I realized it wasn't. And so my mom, you know, she couldn't prevent any of this really, because she was this submissive Southern lady that stayed at home and cooked and cleaned and was submissive to my father. So, so you can only imagine that I thought all men were evil. I hated men. I did not want to be a man. I did not want any part of being a man. And I saw women as being loving and caring. And those were the kind of that though women were the only ones who had been good to me. And so, when I became a teenager, I had been bullied all throughout school, starting in kindergarten all the way up through high school. I remember the first time I was bullied, I was called a faggot in, first grade. And that term stuck with me all throughout my school years. And all the kids, I mean, I literally at one time I thought my nickname was faggot. I mean, it was that everybody just called me that. And so I came out of the closet at 15 years old. And whenever I did, I found this group of students who accepted me, and they, like, no matter what, they were like, they embraced me and brought me into their community. And these kids were all the punk rock gothic kids of my high school. This is back in the day. So, you know, I'm a little bit old, but, and so these kids all, like, just no matter what, they accepted me. So then I didn't know what a transsexual was, mind you. This is in the 90s before being transsexual was cool. You know, like, it was not a trend at that point. There were very few of us, and there were very few that were out about it. So I just knew that I felt female on the inside, and I wanted to present my outer appearance that way. And so I began dressing as a female, going to school as a female, and living my life as a female. And eventually I dropped out of school. I went to Job Corps. At Job Corps, I was really, really enabled to really embrace my feminine side more because my parents were there. I didn't really have authority figure there. The authority figures in that place, they were okay with you being transsexual or gay or any of that, you know. So there was nothing to teach me any different. But I ran away from home and I went to Job Corps. And then from Job Corps, whenever I was first in Job Corps, the very first day being there, I had to go to the men's dorm and I was gay bashed. And these guys put a lock in a sock while I was asleep and beat me in my sleep. And so I ran away from there and I became homeless. I lived on the streets of Austin. I was a street kid. In Austin, Texas, they had have a street called Guadalupe Street. And that was where all the punk rock kids from the 90s who were rejects and their parents disowned them. That's where they lived. And I went there and joined them. And so, then later on in my early adulthood, I began, like when I was 18, I started doing drag. And, from there, I wanted to take my transition deeper. So I went to a gender therapist. And whenever I was at that gender therapist, I went to one 30-minute session, And at that 30-minute session, I was diagnosed with gender dysphoria and given a letter. And this letter gave me the permission to present as female as much as possible. Okay, I was looking to see if I have a picture of the letter, but I guess, but yeah, they wrote this letter, and this letter, we called it back in my day our walking papers, and it allowed me to use a female restroom. As you see, it says this letter is to certify that Kevin Witt, aka Dominique, is a transsexual woman. She is currently in psychological therapy for gender transition. Treatment requires the client to present as female as much as possible. Therefore, she should be treated with respect and afforded all the rights and privileges of a female. Now, that meant I could go to the female's restroom and nobody could do nothing about it. And this is in the 90s, mind you. And so from there, I started taking spironolactone, which is a testosterone blocker. And that, no matter what they say, that does have lasting permanent effect on your body. And I still have permanent effects from that to this day. And I'm 45 years old. So, I started in the adult industry. And I worked in all aspects of the adult industry, from prostitution to I was a phone sex operator. I did webcam modeling. I did porn photo shoots, you name it. I did it. Anything for money, I did. But then I realized a lot of my friends started passing away 1 year. I had about 7 friends pass away in 1 year, all from different things, HIV, suicide, drug overdoses. And so I was thinking, like, am I next? People are checking out. Like, what's going on? I went to memorial service after memorial service after memorial service. I was tired of it. So my best friend got, he lost his job. And so we just chose a spot on the map and moved a way to get away from our problems, you know. So we were going to come to San Francisco, but that was way too expensive. So we settled on Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And now before I moved there to Fort Lauderdale, there was this lady at this job I had. It was a temporary job. I was just trying to get like a paycheck or two to help me move to Florida. And this lady at this job, she was so annoying. She was a Christian. And she would follow me to the break room and be talking to me about the Bible and God. And I was like, oh my gosh, if she don't leave me alone. I tried to avoid her at all cost. Well, lo and behold, whenever she found out I was moving, she was like, can me and my husband take you out to have drinks tonight? I said, sure, anything for a free drink, you know. And so she took me out, and while I don't even think she was drinking, I think she was probably drinking Coke, but I sure was. And she was talking about God the whole time. And she said, when you move to Florida, you are going to meet a group of people that are going to introduce you to God and all this stuff, and your life's going to change. And I thought, this lady is crazy. This ain't happening. I have no desire for God. Like, in my mind, my life was fine. I didn't have any desire to change and none of that stuff. I was depressed, you know. So moved to Florida, and I started working at this gay strip club. And while at that gay strip club, one of these little stripper boys, I was at the bar getting a drink, and he came to the bar, and he was like, hey, Dominique, do you want to go with me to church tomorrow? And now, he's in a thong. He just did a private dance for a guy in the VIP room. And I'm thinking, what? Like, I said, sure, we can go to church. You know, I'm from the South, so, like, everybody goes to church in the South. And I thought it was drunk talk. Definitely didn't think he was going to pick me up the next day. But the next morning, I came home that night. I mean, I was so drunk. I just passed out on the couch, took my clothes off, whatever. Woke up to hearing somebody honking their horn. And I looked out the window and it was him. And I was like, oh my, I guess we're going to church. Well, I didn't even have time to take a shower or anything. So I just had on makeup from the night before. I washed my face a little bit and brushed my teeth and put my hair in a ponytail and put on the clothes I wore at home the night before. And that was skin tight blue jeans, high heels, and a low cut top. So here I went looking like, who knows what I looked like. I mean, when I look back now, and I'm walking into this church, and it's like a big mega church, and there was like all these cameras and all this stuff. And this was Calvary Chapel in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I was like, and I saw all these cameras. I was like, God, I hope I'm not on TV and nobody's like the Christian channel or something. And they see me at this church. People are going to really wondering what I'm doing. And I felt like everybody was looking at me like I had five heads, you know, but I was there and my friend was raising his hands, praising the Lord. And I was like, what is he doing? But on the way back home that night, he told me, he said, they had a ministry there for people in the LGBT community. I was like, oh, really? Because I was trying to figure out why he was going to church. And so he told me about it. And then it planted a seed. I moved back home to Dallas. And one of my friends invited me to church on Easter. And that was where I gave my life to the Lord. Sorry. And that day they gave me a Bible. That was like my gift, you know, and they gave me a Bible. And, you know, I had no plans of changing anything about my life. I thought, well, I'm going to stop going to the club and stop drinking so much and all this stuff. Well, when I started reading this Bible, the scriptures were saying that it was a sin to be gay and all this stuff. And I was like, I was trying to twist and turn and make that not say that, but I couldn't. And so I just prayed and said, God, if you don't want me to be this way, you're the only one that has the power to take away my desire to be a woman and take away my desire to be a man. I mean, to be a female, sorry. And so I started going to this ministry called Living Hope in Arlington, Texas. And there is where I really found healing in my gender dysphoria. And I found that it was okay to be a feminine man. That's okay. And I hated that I was a feminine man my whole life, which was one reason why I transitioned. But it's okay to be feminine. It's okay to, you know, like beautiful things and to have a sensitive personality. That is okay. You don't have to like grab your crotch and watch football on Sundays and go hunting and fishing in order to be a man. You don't have to. I mean, I just keep it real, you know. And so from there I went to Bible college. At Bible college, I went to Christ for the Nations. I majored in evangelism and started doing street ministry. And after that, I'm like running out of time here. I started doing activism. Now I do activism, political. I'm a pro family activist. And, you know, I go and testify before legislation trying to get bills passed, specifically bills to ban pediatric gender transition. I've started my own organization. Huh? Oh, yes. We finally, okay, for 6 years. So I met this man named Jeff Younger in Texas at this pro-family event in front of the Capitol steps, just randomly happened to be there. And his son started getting transitioned to a girl at 3 years old by his ex-wife. And so whenever I met this man, I heard his story and I heard that little boy's name was James. Well, my first name is James. I don't go by it. That's my father's name. But that his, so then I felt like the Lord was telling me to share my testimony and to get involved in activism to help speak into this generation of people. This was 6 years ago. Nobody was really talking about this. Nobody was really talking about detransitioning or anything, but I was, because I was letting people know that children were being transitioned. And it was after meeting Jeff Younger that I found that out. I had no idea. I was a transsexual myself, and I did not know that children were being transitioned. But then I started researching, and I was like, this is happening. So for 6 years, we worked on getting a ban passed in Texas to ban pediatric gender transition. Finally, this past session, we got SB 14 passed, which bans pediatric gender transition. But it's not good enough. The language is not good enough. It does take away a doctor's license, but like my whole thing is, who's going to turn that doctor in? You know? So next session, I'm planning on trying to get a bill passed that redefines child abuse to include pediatric gender transition, hormones, etc. And it's not, and a lot of people are like, well, the parents are not, you know, at fault here, whatever, and they're not child abusers. They may not be, but it is child abuse, you know? And so, yeah, but, so that's what I do. I used to work with many different organizations. Now I'm starting my own organization, the WIT Project, because I don't want to feel like I'm limited on what I can do and what, and say. I used to work for the Texas GOP. I was very limited. So that's why I'm starting my organization. But what I've learned through all this is that if neuroplasticity, which is when the brain is rewired to function in some way that differs from how it was previously functioned, then if that is real, change is possible. Change from homosexuality is possible. any type of change is possible, and change from gender dysphoria is possible. Gender dysphoria is a real mental illness and needs to be treated as such, as a mental illness. You don't restrict food from an anorexic patient, just like you don't affirm gender dysphoria by placing them on hormones. So, and I'll just end by saying this, in the words of a great man of God who I respect a lot, and when I heard this man's testimony, it really changed my life. In the words of Si Rogers, I may have a little residue from my past, but I'm a far cry from pantyhose.
So, Kevin, do you want to tell us about your T-shirt?
Oh.
And we got a picture, don't we?
There's another picture. Okay. So this was a show flyer from a drag show that I did. And it was a drag show dinner theater thing. And so this club, the owners were from California, actually. They named that drag show. I didn't. And they named it God Save the Queen. Well, a couple years later, I got saved. And so my shirt says God Saved the Queen. And the title of my book that I'm writing is God Saved the Queen. And so they were not even Christians, and they spoke prophetically over my life when they created that. So I had to use it. And so, yeah.
Praise the Lord. All right.
It's good to see you all today. Thank you all for coming. So my name is Chloe Cole, and I am a 19-year-old from the Central Valley, and I'm a detransitioner, meaning that I'm somebody who went through the process of a social and medical transition from female to a male identity, and I went back on that decision. And this actually happened over the span of pretty much my entire adolescent years, from the ages of 12 to 16. And religion hadn't always been a part of my life. My dad was raised Mormon, and my mom a Catholic, and I was brought to church up until I was about 5 years old, but both of my parents had their own falling out with the church. My dad's reasoning being that he divorced his previous wife, and who was abusive, and he was excommunicated from the church for this reason. And they wanted to allow me to kind of form my own view of the world without feeling like they're forcing any sort of belief system on me. But in raising me mostly atheist or agnostic, I struggled quite a bit with my beliefs, my values, and with my identity. And especially with the fact that I was female, that I was a girl who would one day become a woman. And from a very young age, I had always kind of been on the tomboyish side, especially as I got older. I just started rejecting things that were traditionally feminine, like the color pink, dresses, purses, skirts, dolls, you name it. And I felt like I related a lot more to my male peers and my older brothers and my dad a little bit more than my sisters and my mother. And I started puberty at a fairly young age. I was about 8 or 9 when my breasts started to develop. So I was going to my fourth grade year. And people were commenting, both adults and my classmates were commenting on various parts of my body. Like my breasts, my hips, my legs, even like the hair on my body. And a lot of the messaging that I was receiving around femininity and being a woman throughout like my late childhood to early adolescent years was very superficial and negative. I mean, femininity was almost like this sort of shameful thing. Like, women who were very feminine were often presented as airheaded, stupid, always getting in the way of things that really matter. And I wanted to be something more than that. And it felt like with all of these magazines and social media and what I was seeing on the TV and hearing from other girls, that a lot of my worth would come down to the way that I looked or my sexuality. And if I didn't have anything to offer in any of those areas, would I even be a good woman? I was constantly comparing myself to the other girls my age, not only in terms of my looks, but also in my interests and my personality. And I felt like I would never match up, that I just wouldn't be happy if I kept living on as a girl. And there were times when I felt that if I were just raised, if I were just born as a boy, I would be so much happier. And by discovering the transgender community online, I found not only a way out of this experience that I didn't want to go through, you know, having to go through the, having to have periods every month for about half of my life, and the scariness of pregnancy and childbirth and menopause and being judged for aging. Now I didn't have to go through any of that. It also gave me an explanation for why I felt so different from the other girls my age, and even like my own female relatives. This community I discovered was through communities around my own personal interests, such as like books, comics, anime, you name it. A lot of the users in these communities were young people who identified as a part of the LGBT. Many of them said that they were gay or bisexual, but an overwhelming amount of them were young women and girls who identified as the opposite sex. And it was such a novel concept to me at the time, the idea that sex and gender were not the same thing, and that you didn't have to live as the sex that you were born as. And the community itself seemed very tightly knit. It seemed to be like people from a variety of different backgrounds, but many of us had many things in common, like that we were artistic people, that we often thought outside the box, and many of us had grown up being neglected or abused or bullied. And as somebody who had gone through a lot of bullying myself and had always felt like an outcast, it hit really close to home. And after a while of starting to question why I felt so drawn to this community, I decided that I was just supposed to be a boy all along. I wasn't supposed to be my mom and dad's daughter. I was their son. And I started cutting my hair shorter. I secretly changed my name a few times, not legally, just going through different identities to sort of feel out what was most comfortable for me. And I wanted to tell my parents for a very long time, but I wasn't exactly sure how to tell them, because I knew even then that it was going to be a very intimidating discussion for both parties. I wasn't sure how they were going to react to it. And I mean, for any parent really, it has to be painful to hear your own child telling you that they feel like they've been born in the wrong body, that they are deeply uncomfortable with the way that they were made. But I saw another member within the community come out to her mother through writing a letter. And for me, this gave kind of a comfortable way of not approaching it directly and kind of giving them some time to think about how they would respond to me. And when they did, they were initially pretty supportive, at least superficially. And they wanted to help me feel comfortable in my own skin and allow me to just experiment with my presentation at this time, while also just allowing me to be a kid. And they were very sensible about it. they didn't want me to be making any permanent decisions until I would at least legally be an adult and more capable of doing so. But they were also kind of concerned about where this is coming from. You know, I'm the youngest of five kids, and there's a bit of a generational gap between me and my older siblings. And they had never really heard about anything remotely like this before from any of them. So they started doing their own research, and online they discovered that our healthcare provider, Kaiser Permanente, was recommended as the top choice in the entire state of California for care of gender dysphoric and trans-identified youth. And to them, at the time, this just meant, well, maybe that means, like, she's going to therapy and they're going to help her with these feelings, with learning how to cope with it until she's an adult and is able to make decisions on her own. They were about to be completely blindsided about what was going to happen next when they hired a therapist for me. And this is something that happened in our own community, actually. I'm from Manteca, and I started seeing a therapist here in Modesto, Kaiser. And this therapist was honestly pretty lousy. He was totally gung-ho about affirming me in my identity by using my preferred pronouns and names and gender. But he wasn't really addressing the issues that I was experiencing at the time, at school, at home. It was all just completely ignored. And as I was going through the diagnostic process, it was the very same. I had been previously diagnosed with ADHD, but it was more likely that I actually was on the autistic spectrum. And I had symptoms that were indicative of a body image disorder and even a potential eating disorder. And all of that was just completely ignored during this process in favor of treating my gender dysphoria, in favor of focusing on the way that I was born. And my mom and dad were getting pretty concerned because I was getting worse. I was becoming more distressed over time, and I started to really push for the physical interventions. And they didn't really understand why. I thought that it was the only choice that I had and that I truly was a boy because I wasn't told any different. None of the adults who were supposed to help me and my family through this were doing so. They told my mom and dad, when they pushed back against this, that children know what their identity is from a young age. It's something that's innate and that they can easily recognize, that I knew what I wanted and that I needed it because it would be life or death. They essentially gave them the ultimatum of either having a suicidal and potentially dead daughter or a living, happy, thriving transgender son. And when you're the mother or a father of a child and you're faced with the possibility of their death, what wouldn't you do for them? So I don't blame them for signing off on these treatments because they were essentially coerced and emotionally manipulated into doing so. So only about halfway through my eighth grade year, just 6 months or less after I was first referred to a psychologist for treatment, was when I was put on puberty blockers. They put me on a medication called Lupron to halt my puberty. And at 13 and a half, I was experiencing symptoms that most women only really start to experience naturally through menopause, starting at around their late 40s or early 50s, including things like hot flashes and accompanied by tingling and itching and even burning sensations in my limbs all over my body. And I was very lethargic in my day to day. It was a miserable way for me to live. And so just a month after I started blockers was when they put me on the testosterone. And compared to being in what was essentially chemically induced menopausal state, This felt amazing. I mean, I was taking a literal steroid. All my energy was back. I started to develop a confidence streak, and my libido skyrocketed. And the physical changes started rolling around about 2 or 3 weeks in, starting with the deepening of my voice, which was very quick, very dramatic. And throughout most of my adolescent years, I actually had a deeper voice than most of my male peers and even some of my male teachers. And my body shape was changing to a more masculine-looking form. And I truly did look like a 14, 15-year-old boy. But there was still one problem for me. I still had my breasts, and I wasn't really making any effort to hide them at all because at the time, in eighth grade, everybody still knew me as a biological female, and I wasn't going to fool them any differently because they had known me for years. But I was being targeted by bullies just for presenting myself differently in a more masculine form, just by wearing different clothing and having shorter hair. And there was one day when one of my classmates had gone too far. He approached me in a classroom, and what he did to me seemed to have gone completely unnoticed by anybody in the classroom. And it was full of other students. The teacher was even there. He looked me in the eyes, and he squeezed one of my breasts. And in that moment, I felt so small because nobody was there to ask me if I was okay or if I needed any help. And the school that I was at the time, I had like a 504 IEP plan with them. And they were just completely ignoring my educational plan. If they weren't helping me with my education, how could I have expected them to help me feel safe and comfortable after having been sexually assaulted on their campus grounds? So I just, the situation went pretty unresolved. I just went with it by telling myself to man up, because I was already in the mindset of being a boy, and I wasn't going to be taken seriously. So I went to my first year of high school, and I started binding my chest using a compression device called a chest binder to hide my breasts. And I looked like pretty much any other boy my age. Nobody really knew any differently. And for a while, it was a pretty great time in my life. I was developing great friendships with boys my age, and there were girls my age that even had crushes on me, and it was kind of a big confidence boost. But after a while, it felt tiring. It felt like I was putting on a mask, and I hated binding every day. I started to realize just how lonely it was, that I wasn't really equipped for this experience as a girl, that there were a lot of things expected of me that I was kind of struggling to match up with, and that I didn't really have as much room to talk about my own personal struggles in my day-to-day. And the testosterone itself made it a lot more difficult to process negative emotions like sadness and anger. And those are things that I was experiencing on a near daily basis. So I started to become more and more depressed. And into my sophomore year was when I was formally diagnosed with and treated for major depressive disorder. And they were medicating me for it, but I just kept getting worse. I wasn't getting any better. My grades were dropping. And because of how the testosterone affected my sex drive, it was nearly uncontrollable for me. I became hypersexual. And I had a lot of online relationships with adult men who were grooming me and taking advantage of me sexually. And just the very fact that I was essentially becoming somebody who I wasn't, all of this was really screwing with my head. None of my doctors really stopped to think, well, she's clearly not responding to treatment. Maybe this is iatrogenic. Maybe it's harming her. They just went further into it. And I started thinking that the problem was with my chest because I was sick of binding every day. I thought that I just wanted to look like any other boy my age because the rest of me looked pretty masculine. But there was still this one part of me, and it was a burden. It felt like a burden to me every single day. So about halfway through my sophomore year was when I started seeking surgery. And the consultation period was only, again, about half a year. And so when I was 15 years old, I underwent a double mastectomy, and both my breasts had been surgically removed. The recovery process was pretty difficult, both mentally and physiologically, and I'm actually still going through it to this day. It's been over 3 years now since I had the operation, and I'm in bandages again because complications have popped up years later. And most of the complications that I'm experiencing today from these medications were not listed on the forms. I started having severe urinary tract issues. I started getting infections pretty frequently, and even like clots of blood and tissue in my urine. And there were times that I would get these sporadic uterine cramps that were worse than any period I had ever had up to that point. And it would bring me to my knees. I would drop to the floor. And over time, I started subconsciously realizing that this was a mistake, that it was destroying me from the inside, but I didn't know how to admit it to myself or the people around me for the longest time because I was in so deep. I no longer looked nor sounded like a girl anymore. I didn't think I even had a chance. And I just kept justifying it in my head as, well, maybe I am just an effeminate boy, and that's okay. Maybe I'm non-binary. Maybe I'm not just a transgender boy. But no matter how I tried to adjust it in my head, I was really starting to miss being a girl. Some of the more simple things like wearing makeup and having my hair long and wearing dresses, I started to do in private, in the comfort of my own room. And it just made me feel worse. Towards the end of my junior year of high school, my school performance had gotten so bad that I had to drop out. And I went into an online-only program with the school district. And one of the classes that I was taking was it was psychology. And the end of the unit was very focused on like parental and childhood psychology and development. And something in me just clicked. I realized that I had a maternal instinct that wasn't really fostered over the years, that I didn't have a chance even of developing. I wanted to become a mother one day. I wanted to have children of my own. I wanted to get married. But how was I going to do that if I was going to be on these treatments that could have affected my fertility and even my general sexual development? How would I be able to bond with my children if I'm supposed to be their mother, but I'm instead taking on the role of their father? Will they call me dad? Will they call me mom? And now that I have just lost my breasts, I won't even have a chance at knowing what that beautiful experience, that unique female experience of breastfeeding your own children is like. And this epiphany broke my heart. I couldn't go on any longer like that. I couldn't keep living this life. I wasn't yet comfortable with calling myself a girl, but I knew that I couldn't keep taking these treatments. I couldn't keep living a lie and telling it to the people around me, my own family, every day. So at 16 years old, less than a year after I had surgery, I stopped transitioning because I couldn't live like that anymore. I wasn't really getting any guidance from my doctors on how to go about this, and I basically had to figure it all out on my own. I wasn't really getting any therapy for the trauma that I had just sustained over the years or any of the underlying conditions that accompanied it. my gender specialist who referred me to the surgery was acting almost completely manipulatively. She would often tell me things like, well, this is just another part of your gender journey, is it not? Isn't this just another transition? It was insulting. She was completely relieving herself of responsibility of what she had done to me and just downplaying the seriousness of what I had been through. And this was effectively the same response that I had gotten from all my doctors. The serious side effects that I was having from these treatments, I had to figure out all on my own. And I'm still trying to navigate it to this day. And on the social side of things, I lost a lot of friends in detransitioning, both from the transgender community and even at school. Now these people who had once celebrated me on this path were cruel to me. The things that they would say to me were often along the lines of, well, you knew better. You were a teenager, not a toddler. You need to take accountability for what you did to yourself. And don't place it on any of us. By talking about your story, your regret, you could be harming the transgender community and preventing people from getting the care that they need as real transgender people. And for a while, I gave in. I shut up. Because I was 16. I didn't know any better, and nobody had ever told me things like this in my life. It hurt. It stung. But I soon realized that there is a whole community of other people just like me who had experiences quite like mine. Those who had been through the ringer with transition and came out of it with damage done to their bodies and with regret and years off of their lives. I realized that these things that my doctors in the broader transgender community had told me were all lies. And I felt furious. It was comforting knowing that I wasn't the only one with this experience, but it also made me so upset that I wasn't. It's not something that I would wish on anybody. And I felt like, I knew intuitively that there were other children who have been affected by this very same ideology. And I felt like I had a responsibility to start speaking out about my experience to help encourage other people who had been through the same thing to let them know that they are not alone. And if any of them want to speak up, they have a voice. And I also want to do the very same for people who are families of transgender or detransitioned people, or even those who don't have any stake in it. Because this is something that has happened in starting in our own community. And it's continuing to happen under our own noses. We don't even know it. I don't think there's any better time than now to begin speaking the truth in love. Thank you.
Wow. Thanks for being here, everybody. I know we've all said that, and it does mean a lot to us for people to take these issues seriously. And so much of, I feel like the way that God wants to use our stories isn't just about the LGBT community. It's also to expose the reality that in the church, most of us are living double lives. Can we be honest about that a little bit? That whether it's sexual brokenness, and as Russell was saying earlier, it is rampant. Men dealing with pornography issues, women increasingly as well, other forms of sexual sin, and then other things, whether it's food addictions or it's substances or whatever, we in the church are not immune to seeking comfort and self-gratification and all of those things outside of those areas. Right? I mean, we're in this together. Russell mentioned earlier that we're all broken. We're not just all broken, but we're sexually broken as well. And so even though I grew up in a Christian home, here's my family now. my wife, Melissa, my two boys, Jaden and Dylan. And Jaden just turned 14, and I know I'm not very tall, but he's 3 inches taller than I am, which just drives me crazy. I'm not sure where all that comes from, but this is a representation. You can just leave this up while I'm talking, but this image is a representation of something that a good God has given to a child of his that I thought at one time in my life I never wanted. I never wanted to be married to a woman. I never wanted to be sexually involved with a woman. I was exclusively same-sex attracted. I thought that I would be the worst father in the world, never wanted to have children. But for the grace of God, these are three people, but two of the greatest joys of my life is being a husband to my wife, Melissa, who's no wallflower. She's from New Jersey, so, you know. And my boys. I mean, what an incredible thing to be not only a father naturally and biologically, but to be a father, a spiritual father. I mean, God is crazy gracious. And at one time in my life, I thought, I actually, not just one time in my life, for a season of my life, I despised God. I despised who I thought God was. So let me just fill in a little bit of the story here. When, and it really begins for me, and I know, you know, on a dark, rainy night and whatever, you know, state I was in, I was born, but it actually begins before then. So really at my conception was where some things went awry, because I'm the youngest, like Chloe mentioned, she's the youngest of five kids. I'm the youngest of five as well. And my oldest brother just turned 80 last month. I just turned 58 today, actually. And so what a huge gap. Well, yeah, the fact that I'm 58, which seems so old back in the day, of course. The fact that I'm 58, without the grace of God, I wouldn't have lived into my 30s, I don't believe. But what happened is that my parents thought they were done having kids. Like, they were excited to be done having kids with my last sibling, who's 5 years older than I am. And I have three older brothers, one older sister. And when my parents found out that my mom was pregnant, they were not happy about that at all. And when I was born, my mom came around to really love me well. Thank God for those chemicals that kick in at birth, you know, and my mom loved me well. I really was pretty bonded to my older sister, but my dad for the longest time was very unhappy about having another kid. He basically just determined to just let me be raised by my mom. And my older brothers are all old enough that they didn't want me running around with them and their friends. I mean, totally understandable. But here's the thing, is from even pre-birth, there is this sense, this very clear sense of I'm not wanted. I mean, I didn't have the sense at the time, obviously, but this sense that carried with me from conception pretty much until I was born. And then when I began to be able to reason and understand, the feeling was I'm unplanned for, I'm unwanted, I'm in the way, I'm a bother. Like that, those were labels and themes that I didn't even have language for in the beginning, but they were definitely feelings that I felt. And those things carried on into much of my life. We went to church every Sunday. We were in church multiple times during the week. And when I went to school for the first time, to a public school, I experienced a lot of bullying. The bus, how many would agree with me that the school bus has got to be like one of the worst subcultures on the planet, right? I mean, horrible. And by the way, if one of you were the ones that were doing the bullying, shame on you and on, you know, on the school bus or at the school. But anyway, what I experienced in that bullying, though, and that rejection and that tearing down by my own gender, particularly, gym class was a nightmare. The locker room was just a freak show, you know, and having to get up and face that every day. I don't look back on my childhood. I don't have memories of looking back on a happy childhood. In many ways, growing up in upstate New York, living in the country, being able to have that kind of rough and tumble kind of life and hunting, fishing, those kinds of things, the things that Kevin mentioned earlier as well, that was kind of a part of our family. We all did that. In many ways, I look at that and I think, oh, I would give anything to kind of be in that setting again. I mean, I love that sort of thing now, gardening, all that kind of stuff. But growing up, I felt so isolated and so alone and so empty and so rejected constantly. And the only place that I could find connection was in the world of the feminine. So when at my home, it was mom and my sister. In school, it was girls all the time. Even at church, I was around girls more often than boys. And it felt to me like even whether it was boy peers my age or it was even older men, there was a way in which I was, there's something wrong with him. There's something just not right about this kid. And so there was that constant getting rejected and pushed out of things, name-calling, the labeling, faggot, all those kinds of things as well. And about the age of 5 or 6, on one of these bus rides, I was in kindergarten or first grade, and one of these bus rides home from school to home, an older neighborhood boy said, "Hey, Gary, why don't you come over and play with us after school?" Well, I didn't get that kind of invitation for reasons I already explained. A lot, the boys didn't want to hang out with me. So I was super excited, went home, changed my clothes, and went over to their house. And it turns out the only reason they invited this 5 or 6 year old kid over to their house, and there were probably 5 boys, many of them had already, hit puberty, but their mom and dad were gone, but they knew where their dad's hardcore porn stash was. So they got the magazines out and they flipped page after page after page after page after page for me to stare at this stuff. And they're roaring because, I couldn't even quite understand what I was looking at. I mean, I knew what I was looking at, but it was this bizarre thing. So when I left there, in addition to that, my memory, I still have a very clear memory of some of those early images that happened way back then. They just got emblazoned into my brain. And then my memories goes totally black just after there was, sexual engagement happening with the boys. And they're acting out what they're watching and seeing in these magazines. And I don't recall any of that other than the fact that I was there. I don't know to what degree they involved me or didn't, if I was just present watching or what. But I left that place feeling like already a kid who came there struggling. And now I've got all this crap on me. I have all this shame. But there was also this odd thing that happened over the course of weeks and months later. Is I began to, I felt so dirty and so shameful about what happened, but there was a way in which it met a need as well. And I didn't have understanding or language for that. It was just something as I look back, I realized was happening. Proverbs, I think it's Proverbs 27, I think it's verse 17, that says, to a sated man, honey is detestable, a man or woman. To a man who's full, honey is detestable, but to a famished man, any bitter thing is sweet. And so I was this walking void, this emptiness, and I had all these needs that God created me to have. And by the way, you have these needs too. There's needs that God created us to have that even within the church, even within our Christian families, we don't do necessarily a great job of pouring into those needs directly. I hear all the time as I travel and speak and do trainings and conferences, I hear from parents all the time and my heart breaks for them because I connect with how my parents also felt. My parents have both gone home to be with the Lord now, but they'll say to me, we didn't raise our child to fill in the blank, whatever that is, right? Be off in the weeds. I mean, some of you are feeling that right now and aware of that, but And in many cases, moms and dads pour into our children with a whole heart of love. It's not just information that we're putting in, but we're trying to love them well through some, whether it's a missing each other because of different love languages or whatever, or the way that children perceive things very differently. There's, David Siemens wrote a book years ago called Healing for Damaged Emotions. And in that book, he mentions that children are the best recorders of information, but the worst interpreters of that information. But that's one of the reasons that we desperately need moms, but also our dads. Too many times we as kids are left to figure out life by ourselves, even in Christian homes. I'm not saying that out of condemnation. It's a hard, being a mom and dad are difficult things, no doubt about it. But so often we are expecting church to raise our children, rather than actually dads especially shepherding the hearts of our sons and our daughters. And so I went through all of my childhood empty and lonely and longing for something that God created to be there, But my dad, for the longest time, just completely bypassed that. Now, Dad and I became very close after I became an adult, moved out of the house. He softened, and I got to a place where I didn't think he was as dumb as I, you know, thought he was when I was a teenager and all that. And he and I developed this great relationship. He passed away on hospice in our home at 88 years of age. He and I lived together. My mom lived with us too, for quite a few years before they both went on, home to be with the Lord. And I'm so grateful for the relationship that God gave me and my dad. He got to see my very first son born, Jaden. He got to, and then my mom was alive for my second son to be born. God redeemed so much. But in that space of all that sexual brokenness, I began to realize that before long, when I hit puberty, I was a porn addict. When I hit puberty, I would do anything I could to get my hands on it. Thank God there was no such thing as an internet back there. I can't even imagine what my life would have been like. The stuff that I saw back then that was so defiling to me ain't nothing compared to the garbage that kids are seeing these days in a couple clicks. And not having anyone to process that stuff with, when I would try to bring things up, it was unsafe in my home. My dad was kind of explosive about that stuff. If I questioned things about God, or I was trying to engage in a conversation about us being closer, he would get really upset because it felt to him like he was failing in some way. And rather than actually pressing in and seeing how to maybe be a better father or what I needed uniquely from the other kids, it was just something that stirred up feelings of his own unhealed brokenness. And so he responded in ways that actually shut me down. And so I detached from him. I detached from God. I went through the motions of a Bible, of the scriptures and being in a Christian home, went to church all the time. As I said, my parents pulled me out of public school, put me into Christian school. And that didn't go well either. I bounced back to public school. Then I went into homeschooling. So I've had all the illustrious, wonderful experiences of lots of different education. And then I graduated early and I didn't know what to do with myself. So I applied to a local Bible college where one of my brothers was finishing up his last year. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm going into Bible college, and when I got hooked on pornography, what I realized also is that I was drawn not to images of women, but the images of men. And I was horrified by that. And so I began to pray and pray and pray that God would take these things away. And to a kid growing up in church and in Christian circles and Christian family, praying and praying to God and thinking, well, your word says this. I get it. I agree with that. I'm asking you to change me, and nothing happens. Day after, I'm thinking in a couple of days, in a week, this is all going to change. Well, it doesn't. Months go by, nothing changes. And so in my own mind, again, I'm recording everything, and I'm the worst interpreter of that stuff that's going on inside of me, right? And so I got to a place where I became really bitter. And as I said very early on, I got to a whole season where I really hated God. Because where were you when that abuse happened to me at 5 or 6 years of age? Where were you then? And I know that's not the only thing that had to do with it. What's going on in terms of this brokenness in my own family and between my dad and I? I didn't ask to be born. I mean, all these things are swirling around in my mind. And I went through seasons of just being so bitter and so hateful toward God. And I'm reminded oftentimes today that when I was so angry with God, and so full of hate for a long season of time, actually, God never led me into sin. He never blessed my sin, but he knew that I'd be sitting here today talking to you as well. He knew that he was going to give me a family that was beyond anything I ever thought that I could even want or imagine or desire. He knew that he was going to give those things to me, even while I was being a spoiled, rotten brat to him. So I wound up getting kicked out of Bible college. I quit twice, went back again, third time's a charm. And I got kicked out a third time because the school thought that I was suicidal. They didn't have any way of really walking with me in that space. So at 19 years of age, I'm given the boot from Bible college. I left, again, full of rage at God, full of rage at the church, and I'm just done. It wasn't long after that somebody made an offhanded comment about a gay bar in the town not far from where I was living. I'd never even thought there was anything like that in the state, let alone in a town nearby. I was like a moth to the flame. At 19 years of age, I found my first gay bar, scared to go in. Took me forever to find the place in the first place. They weren't hanging, pride flags up, you know, outside of gay bars at that point. And, but I finally found it, scared to death to go in. I'd never had a drink in my life, never had a, never been drunk in my life, never been in a bar in my life. And I finally found this place. And you know, it was like I finally found my people at 19 years of age. Christian home, Christian church, Bible college, finally found my people in the gay bar at 19 years of age. And that, honestly, that I had choice in that for sure, absolutely. But it also, I think, pulls back the curtain a little bit on the church. Wouldn't you agree? And my church wasn't a bad church. My church was a run-of-the-mill, everyday kind of church where people, many people loved Jesus. They wanted to serve him. But we were the church that had lots of secrets, like what I've realized now is the case in every church. We were living, nobody was living out the goodness of God and declaring his wonders and declaring what he had been bringing them through, or getting real and honest about the stuff that we're actually wrestling with and struggling with, that has a hold on us, a grip on us, and that we're not breaking free of. Instead, we're trying to work it out in our prayer closet and not invite anybody else into. But according to James 5:16, James writes this: confess your sins to one another and pray for each other that you might be healed. Healed. We get forgeven directly from Jesus, 1 John 1:9, when we confess our sins. But healing comes through letting some other people into that space, and almost none of us in the church are doing that. And it is destroying our children. The younger generations, the millennials and youngers, can't stand the church because it feels so completely irrelevant to anything that they're going through, because they know that there's a lot of hypocrisy in the church. And it's okay. Listen, we're a mess. And it's okay that we're in a process and on a journey. But the problem is we're not letting anyone into that journey. So for kids and young people growing up in that environment, I felt like I was uniquely broken and uniquely struggling, and something was terribly wrong with me. And the truth is, no, there's something terribly wrong with all of us. And Jesus made a way for us to find redemption and salvation. So God eventually brought me to a church back in upstate New York. I grew up in upstate New York. I traveled all around the country. I was in California. I was in Arizona. I was in Texas. I was in Chicago. In my mid-30s, God finally brought me to a church in upstate New York, back in my hometown, where I swore I'd never go back to again, that was dealing with really broken people. And the people of that church, the pastor, the men in that church, don't have all the time to get into all the details, but they surrounded me with love and compassion, not winking at my sin, knowing that God had something more for me than that. It was really through them that God began to break through and restore me. But there's something more than that. God didn't just have in mind for me to stop doing naughty things. I thought for all of my life, if I could stop doing, you know, looking at porn and living in chronic masturbation and having sex with other people and those kinds of things, that somehow life would be good. Well, you know what? There is a benefit to not doing those things, obviously. But God has more for us as Christians than not just doing naughty things. He has more. He has a kingdom purpose and eternal value for us that far extends beyond anything that most of us can even ask or imagine. And every son and daughter of his has a kingdom calling, an eternal purpose, and an eternal value that he's called us into. And so he's rescued me out of the mess that I was in, us out of the messes that we've been in, so that we can actually declare the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living today. And so we hope that this is encouraging to you. And I'm just so thankful to be here and be a part of this. And so bless you, and thanks for listening to our stories. But you have a story too. And I want to encourage you to find some other men or women. It's a band of brothers, band of sisters, and start telling your stories together. Thank you so much.